This is the first tape of an interview with Hara Hackton, part of the Faculty Wives series of the UW Archives, or Oral History Project. The interviewer is Carol Belo, took place in March.
Yeah.
I guess we can just start right out with your background. You've already said where you were born, but what was your education background?
I've been in journalism. Both educationally and professionally all along. I went to Stanford, got a BA in journalism there, and then I went to Columbia School of Journalism and got an MS. And then after after Columbia, I worked in New York for a number of years doing radio news, hourly radio news reports for WQXR, which was then the music station, and shortly after I left, was bought by the New York Times, their station. And then I went back to Los Angeles, my home, and worked for newspapers there. And then in the 50s, I was assistant professor of journalism in the graduate program at UCLA. And I did that until my husband decided to get a PhD, and we moved to Minnesota in 56.
What made you decide to go into journalism? Is this something you always wanted to do?
Oh, yeah. I'd been working. I kind of got the bug in high school, worked on the school paper and that sort of thing, and I had pretty much decided that's what I wanted to do. Actually, my father was a civil engineer, and I was very close to him, and I had a mathematical bent, which I always like to think suffered from the lack of math instruction at the high school level, at least the high school I went to in the days I went there. And I spoke of being an aeronautical engineer. As a matter of fact, I was hung up on airplanes, and but that was not socially acceptable, at least from my mother's point of view. You know, girls don't become engineers,
right,
sort of thing. And
journalism was okay.
Journalism was okay, even though not many girls, you know, I mean, it was still legitimate. Anyway, that was my other interest. And I never thought of anything else after I sat on that course.
Did you meet your husband at Stanford?
Actually, no. He went to Stanford, but he was there after the war, and I was there around the war, World War II, the war. And we didn't meet. No, we met at UCLA. As a matter of fact, he was one of my students, which was a switch.
Right.
Yeah, he was a professional. He played professional football after he got out of college, and then was out of, so he was out of school for a while, and then came back to get a master's in journalism, which is, he had been a journalism graduate at Stanford, too. And he was working for newspapers in Los Angeles when he decided to go on to get a PhD. He got his master's in the program at UCLA.
I see.
Which is where I met him.
So then he went on to
That's right.
What made you choose Madison?
Well, I didn't choose it. He did.
How did you feel about him?
Oh, well, that's fine. I was born and raised in Los Angeles, and I was not comfortable there anymore. Mostly because it had become so crowded and such a big city. I was not sorry to leave LA. And when we went to Minnesota, we had Liz, the one who just left, was 9 months old, and then the following year, our second daughter was born, and it was a new life, and I liked it. I could never imagine going back to live.
So he was in school, and you had the two young children.
Yes.
That was a really trying time.
It was difficult. Looking at the time, it was very difficult. When I say, you know, it was a new beginning, that's from the perspective of almost 30 years now, or 28 years. It was difficult.
At the time, it time, did you feel as though you were stepping back in a way, career-wise, or?
Not really stepping back. What I felt then was real cabin fever, because up until then, you see, I had worked. And then come and with all the support system I had at home or in Los Angeles, I could continue to work after Liz was born, but it was a very short time. She was born in February and we left in September, August. Anyway, so I was housebound, is what it was. And I had worked so long, and I had married, you know, later than most people. And so I was 30. And then Liz came along a couple or 3 years later. So I'd never not worked, you know, as an adult. I'd never had never been in a situation where I didn't have contact and stimulation of going out to work and being with people. And the first year in Minnesota, we were in a house right near campus, and I almost immediately got pregnant again, so that I didn't feel it so much that year. But the second year, then, we went to live in student housing, which were converted barracks. And by the time we got in there, Mariano had already arrived, so it was two small kids in a half of a army barracks is what it was. They were cut in half and made into two apartments, and it was close. Close living. Really was tough. And it was a tough time in those days, you know. Graduate assistants didn't get the kind of pay they get nowadays, and going from two incomes to, I think it was $1,500 for 9 months was really tough. And I got pretty stir crazy. Also, I was in a milieu that was very unfamiliar to me. All the other people on my street, so to speak, in this housing development, that I was closest to in proximity, were all, well, not all, most of them were undergraduate students' wives. There were a few graduate student wives, but they were most all from the Midwest that had been into things like baking bread from scratch and, you know, being very housewifely, which is nothing I had ever experienced before. So I had some social difficulty finding. I didn't find any close friends there at all. Acquaintances, lots, but not any.
So were you kind of relieved to maybe coming to Madison? Then
oh, yeah, Madison was
very optimistic.
True. It was optimistic, but, you know, it was funny coming here and then going to the University Houses, which is where we went for the first year and a half or two. Almost, it was just better class housing, but a similar milieu. The people were much more in tune with me than my neighbors in Minnesota. It was still that communal living, which is very different from Southern California living. You know, Southern. In fact, the thing that I've always noticed about the biggest difference between Middle West and California is that Middle West, very few people have fences in their backyards, or, you know, if they do, they're very low. But in Southern California, you build walls. Your backyards are enclosed by walls, you know. I mean, there are, so nobody sees into your backyard. And that, to me, has sort of always been the epitome of Southern California style. And I find close living, like, get in the university houses, sometimes hard.
Why did your husband choose?
Well, I think it was probably the best offer, as I remember, but no, I don't think in terms of money it was. There was something from Texas, but the head of the School of Journalism at Minnesota was very close to Ralph Nafziger, who was the head here, and in fact Ralph Napster at one time had been at Minnesota. And I think he may have even been Casey's classmate. This was Ralph Casey up in Minnesota. Anyway, in those days, you know, your mentor, who, and that was Ralph Casey, said, this is the place for you and this is where you should go. And I don't think Bill really disagreed with him.
And you went along that you were agreeable to.
It never occurred to me not to be in those days.
It changed a little bit.
Yeah.
What was your impression when you first got here, other than this change in student housing?
Oh, well, that seemed terribly grand, you know, after it was much nicer than a half of an army barracks, I'll say that. No, everyone was very nice. It was better in the winter. I happen to, I've always said, of all the things in the world, I could never be as a kindergarten teacher, because I really think people's, the formation of their ears and eardrums are very different. You know, some people can stand certain sounds that I can't stand, and one sound I can't stand is the pitch of lots of children's voices, and you sure got lots of children's voices at university houses. It was better in the winter when the windows were all closed. But I liked it, and we made some marvelous friends. I thought it was the best way to, looking back, to meet people that you'd never meet otherwise.
In the
university houses, yeah. We didn't know anybody at all when we came, and right away you have a whole pool of people with whom it's very easy to become friends. And we've kept, there is a group of us who've been quite close all these years that all came about the same time in university houses. In fact, we're planning to have a 25th party in the fall we had one on the 10th anniversary of all of us coming, and we're going to have one marking the 25th. Those of us who were left up here, left here, and a lot of people moved away.
Mm-hmm.
A few have died. Well, I don't know what you mean by quite a few.
In comparison to how many,
the original group. Really quite a few. Mm-hmm.
So this was your main contact socially at first?
At first, yeah.
What about the department? Was there
the department, journalism in the past has always been very good about socializing within the department, unlike some I've heard about. We would have met those people. What I meant, university houses, was a place where you could meet people out of your department,
mm-hmm.
and other disciplines that you normally might not.
Being in the same field as your husband, I would imagine that you felt very much a part then of the social climate at journalism school.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Did you join University League?
Yes. At first they were, yeah. I joined newcomers in those days. It was called the Junior League, rather than the newcomers. And there was some kind of, I was talking to a friend of mine, a contemporary up there, trying to remember what the whole thing was about. But there was some kind of a big upheaval in the Junior League the second year I was there, I think. And I got involved in it, and I was on the board. Either I was called in because somebody left or resigned over this, or it's a very hazy thing. But I've often wondered if the whole thing wasn't the result of a lot of general unhappiness of some of the women up there being that wouldn't happen today, let's say that, because of the different social climate for women nowadays. Mm-hmm. You know, there were so many very talented women, wives up there that were working, as I was, home with small kids, and there really wasn't that much to keep you mentally occupied. Although, you know, we read a lot and talked a lot, but...
So there was sort of a frustration?
I think so. Looking back and seeing some of these women have gone on to do things, you know, that I'm sure today's, if they'd been born 20 years later and today was, they were in that situation, they would either be at the university or working or whatever, even though their kids were small at the houses.
You know. Do you think they recognized what the problem was?
No, I don't. Well, I don't know. But it probably, whatever the fuss was about, was probably bigger than the actual substance of it, mostly because that's all there was to do, you know, or that was one of the things to do that could keep you occupied.
Well, did you do a lot of entertaining?
Not a lot. When we got there, we were really broke. after 3 years, you know, we had no savings left, and we did some. Yeah, we did some and potlucking and that sort of stuff. But not a lot, not as much as I did later when things got a little better.
But did you have students come? Did you do entertaining for your husband?
No, I don't recall. We didn't start entertaining students until later. Well, for one thing, Bill came without his PhD, and they were pretty, I guess they still are, about you don't take on graduate students until you have that. And I mean, he got his, we came in 59, he got his in 60, or 61, technically 61. So those first 2 years, it wasn't a problem. But I would say that a good deal of the entertaining was directed at journalism, faculty friends in journalism, as I would call that.
Did you, during this time, feel that you wanted to become more active in journalism yourself?
Oh, yeah. I always look forward to going back to work, yeah. And the first thing as soon as my second one was toilet trained, she joined the first at Unitarian nursery school, at the nursery school in the Unitarian church. I forgot what they called it. I got involved in the Kennedy campaign in 60, in the fall of 60, and I was publicity director for the statewide director for Citizen for Kennedy. I did it all out of my house, and what I was doing is writing news releases and that sort of thing and mailing them around. So that was something I could do. And then I guess I told Les Hawks, who was the man on the faculty in charge of placement, that I was really, I'd love to get back. I wanted to go back to work. And he knew that. And then in early 1961, something opened up in the State Journal. And they called him, one know if he knew of someone, and he recommended me. And I went to work there in March 61. So for the last 6 months we were at the houses, I was working three-quarter time. I worked 30 hours a week.
That was even at that time quite unusual.
It was.
With young children. How did your peers feel about that, or your husband?
Well, my husband was in favor of it. I wasn't very happy those last months before I went to work. You know, I really, after the election and that all died down, I was really beginning to feel the being closed in. Also, we, you know, we were financially, it was almost a necessity at that point. And let's see, he had finished his degree, or finished the thesis, like in, it was accepted in December of 60. which meant that he was too late for to become an assistant professor with the raise that would get, you know, the way the cycle is. So that didn't come until the fall of 61. And so he had come as an instructor. So, you know, salaries in those days were still pretty low. So he didn't mind. I know one woman. Well, the hardest part was finding help, finding somebody to be there when the kids came back from nursery school. And I don't recall there were people who took kids in at the houses. Although I was talking to my friend, she mentioned somebody whom I don't remember at all who did that, who babysat in her home. I don't know why I didn't know about it. Anyway, I finally found a graduate student's wife, I believe she was Japanese, who was very sweet and nice and quiet and didn't say boo to the kids. it wasn't the best of all situations. And then summer came and, you know, Bill could take over. And then in June we moved out of the houses and I was able to find somebody who came in the afternoons when they were there. That was the hardest thing, is getting good help. Plus the fact, since I'll continue with the hard things even after we left, is this quaint custom that they had here, they don't anymore, of sending the kids home for lunch from grammar school every day, so that somebody had to be there over the lunch hour when they were small. And I know I once, Ruth Doyle, I don't know what she was doing at the university in those days, at that time, whether she had gone to the law school to be dean, but she was on the school board, and I met her, I know, at a party after about 3 years of this, and I said, oh, you're just the person I want to see. I want you to try to do something about this rule, because by then my kids were at Randall, and I had talked to the principal about letting him take a bag lunch, and oh, no, he said, we believe they should, you know, every child should go home and have a hot lunch. And I said, how do you know they're getting a hot lunch even when they go home, you know? It could just be a sandwich and some fruit. Well, anyway, I told her that, you know, it's very hard. She said, oh, I wouldn't dream of it. She said, I think that they should go home, and I always go home and be there with them. I think it's the best part of the day. I thought, okay, you think so. But that was very difficult, I thought. At least there was not the community support there is now. But at the houses, the people that I was very friendly with, they didn't consider it very strange, or all that strange, or at least they didn't express it to me. However, a woman who lived sort of kitty corner from us, and whom I didn't know, and I frankly didn't like, because she screamed at her kids all the time, and up there, if you scream at your kids, everybody hears it, or everybody around. But anyway, she felt incumbent upon herself to come to see me one afternoon and tell me what a rotten thing I was doing to my kids.
To go back to her.
To going, yeah, to leaving them. I have been left with the impression that there were those who thought it was not a very proper thing to do. But that was the only person that ever said anything. And I was very annoyed because I had gone to so much trouble to be sure they weren't just running loose, you know. The little Japanese wife was, I know she kept them within sight all the time. And it wasn't they weren't latchkey children or anything like that.
Well, you said your husband helped a lot.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
With the children.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Did he help with, you know, a lot of other jobs around the house?
Yeah, over the years, particularly when we went when we moved out of the houses, and we lived in Virginia Terrace 2 years, and then we bought this house. So we've been here since 63. But I know once I said I wanted a dishwasher, he said, "What do you need a dishwasher for? You already have one." Meaning himself. He always used to do the dinner dishes. Yeah, he was. He's always been very good, very supportive. He's very, very supportive.
What about the faculty-wise within the department?
I don't think they. At least they never indicated anything to me. My feeling is that. Most of them knew enough about journalism and, you know, what it was all about to not look at this critically. I don't recall, although all the rest were traditional in the sense of staying home. That when this woman, I had a lot of doubts. You know, I did wonder whether I was doing the right thing. And as I told, who was it that called me? to do this?
Laura.
Laura, yeah. It's male. I wanted to say Vancina, and I knew that was wrong. It's male. That about that time, Margaret Mead was doing a lot of writing about how it's the quality of the time you spend with your kids, not the quantity, that is very important. And this is what I really helped sustain me and helped me get over whatever guilt I had about it was because I knew that the quality was much improved because I was much happier working than if I didn't work and was around when they came home.
Were you able to leave your work at the office?
Yeah, the kind of job I had, right. Yeah. I was a women's editor of the State Journal, and I did that until the beginning of 69. That kind of a job, you have to lay out a page each day, and when it's done, it's done. You don't. Although there are times when I had something to write, and I always, my style is I think about it a lot, and I work a lot on the lead in my mind before I start anything, and it used to be a joke, you know, don't bother mother, she's making up the lead, but it wasn't that, it wasn't, yeah, it wasn't, I didn't bring a briefcase home full of stuff, no.
What about your husband, did he sometimes have to bring work home? He did a lot of writing.
Oh, yes, he's done a lot of writing. Oh yeah, he works at home and required silence when he was up there in his office. Yeah, I didn't want a lot of yelling and screaming. The kids also, you know, don't bother, be quiet, daddy's writing or whatever.
Right. Did you help him at all when he was writing?
Yeah, we've always edited each other. And his last, is it two or three books? Partly because of the women's movement, I now insist that I get some title page credit rather than just an acknowledgement. So it's been that way.
And edited by.
Or with the collaboration of. Yeah, that's the way it usually appears. Or the editorial collaboration.
Well, you were here to see the development of the women's movement.
In fact, I interviewed Betty Friedan when she came to Madison to give a speech shortly after, or, you know, maybe a year after the book came out. Of course, it was great for me. I mean, that totally quashed any doubts, lingering doubts I may have had. By then, I was so much in the routine that I
could you see a lot of changes in the department and their attitudes toward women?
In his department?
Mm-hmm.
Toward professional women or wives or
toward,
what?
As a result of the women's movement.
Well, for one thing, there've always been, a good proportion of women in journalism. I think it's, in my day, it was a nice thing to major in. And so because not many women went into it, actually, you know, but it was a nice to know how to write and sort of a genteel major if you didn't get carried away, you know, sort of thing. So I don't think in terms of number of students, although now I think they're at least half and half, if not more women, I don't know. But you certainly see a greater effort to get women faculty and be supportive. One thing about journalism, and I think it's generally true that at the entry level, there was not much discrimination in terms of salary, if any at all. I always worked for union papers, so there was never any salary, except till I went to the State Journal. There, you know, salary was set by contract, so you didn't get the kinds of discrimination you might have otherwise. Of course, as you went up the ladder, that's where the discrimination came in. Women didn't get promoted to editorial editing jobs or editors' jobs the way men would. Oh yes, it's gone.
Right. Yes. Then when did the changes start taking place, and that women got more promotions?
In journalism?
Right.
Do you mean in the department or in the field?
In journalism generally, and in the field.
Well, I don't think it's all that widespread, frankly. Even now, I mean, the bigger papers like New York Times and Washington Post and places like that, they'll put women where they haven't been before. But I'd say it's still most places around the country. There's still mostly male editors, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think the general tenor has improved, it's mostly the women's movement. It's groups of women within the various staffs of the papers are just not letting their male colleagues get away with what they used to get away, either in terms of treatment of themselves or treatment of women in papers, and they're quite vocal.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to take a while, I think. Of course, you know, the jobs at the top are so scarce anyway that a lot of men wait a hell of a long time, too.
Right, right.
But I just think women are being more aggressive about it.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly it was the women's movement that did that,
mm-hmm.
that's responsible for that.
You mentioned the Faculty Association here on campus.
Of women?
Yes.
The Association of Faculty Women,
mm-hmm.
you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Of people who worked on the campus.
Right, to try and get some of these changes in.
Yes, yes.
Can you tell them about
that? Well, I covered that for the Milwaukee Journal, that movement. That was in the early 70s. It was 71 and 72, I guess, 70, 71, 72. And that was a group of women who got together to institute some of these changes, particularly under... I keep getting 9 and 12 mixed up. Well, you know, the one that the Supreme Court just now overthrew or threw out as being only specifically with the was just last week. Chapter 11, I guess it's mm-hmm. called. They were fighting for their rights under that, and they. I don't know if they brought suits here, but several suits were filed, or at least grievances with the whatever the federal agency was that oversaw it, and they were trying to get a better deal for all the women that were academic specialists. There were very, very many women, overqualified women for the jobs they were doing. They were generally, or I would say the majority, were faculty wives, and that they were doing essentially faculty work, but not getting either the pay, the tenure track, the benefits, anything involved with it. And Plus, there were a whole list of other grievances, which I'm not sure I could reel off at this point. But it was directly as a result of that group that finally that there was appointed, and I think Serena Pondrum was the first, some vice chancellor for women's affairs. And then later it was Marion Swoboda in central administration in a comparable job. And this was all out of that agitation.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved directly with this group, or did you just cover
it? No, I just covered it for the Milwaukee mm-hmm. Journal. Yeah, I was not involved with it.
How did these kinds of things affect your goals? What were your goals when you first started out? You said you wanted to be an engineer first, but
yeah.
then you went into journalism. But how did you? What kind of a journalist did you envision yourself as? Did you?
Oh gosh, you know, when I was dreaming as a kid, I wanted to be a foreign correspondent, but I never was that. But I always liked to cover. City side, or what they call city side, you know, general news.
Mm-hmm.
I did in Los Angeles, where I worked for a number of years. I did that sort of thing, as well as I did a court beat for about 2 years, civil courts, covering the civil courts in Los mm-hmm. Angeles, and I also worked on the drama desk, both doing stories, reviews, as well as editing the pages. And you mean when I got here, what did I think of doing?
Well, yes.
Well, by then I was more of a realist. And the newspaper possibilities were limited to two at that time, you know. Mm-hmm. And as it turned out, the one I was able, there was an opening in the women's department here at the State Journal, and of the women's editorship, and that was what I managed to get.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, when I went back to work, I really, with my children so small, I didn't really want to be totally full time, and this was an ideal situation because I could. It was about 30 hours a week is against 35, which was the working day. But that gave me a lot of flexibility of when I could do. I could go and do my work and leave if I had to, or I could do other things that had to be done. I just could choose my own time, essentially.
Did you ever feel held back career-wise because of your family?
Well, you know, I just didn't think in those terms. Mm-hmm. Even though I chose a career that was sort of different, you know. I mean, in those days, not that it was unheard of for women to go into it, but it was still a man's field, and mm-hmm. I was trying to crack a man's field. I was still a person of my time, you know, and I didn't think in terms, once I got married, of equality in that sphere.
Mm-hmm.
So. I've often, I mean, sure, I never made it to be a foreign correspondent. You know, I don't sit and grieve for it because mm-hmm. I've done so mm-hmm. much traveling, but
mm-hmm.
And I've written from abroad, so I guess in that sense you could say I sometimes mm-hmm. have had a little of it. But I didn't. And I'm basically not all that aggressive a person. Maybe if I were young and growing up now, it would be different, but I probably could have done more had I really pushed myself and, you know, wanted
to.
Did
your husband encourage you to push yourself?
Well, yeah, he's always pushing me. I tell him what do I need a mother for? I have you, you know. But, I mean, as far as my writing goes,
mm-hmm.
yeah, he's always been very supportive. I often said I couldn't do it without him, I mean, in terms of going back to work. And even though we're in the same field, essentially, he's really quite without any professional jealousy at all. You know, I mean, in fact, when I was working on the State Journal and my name was well known, people would, you know, they'd say, oh, are you related to Harva Hackton? He said, yes, I'm Mr. Harva Hackton, you know, and he'd do it as a joke. He didn't mind that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was very supportive.
Well, traveling, now you've been out of the country
yes,
a lot.
Yes, yeah.
Did that kind of interrupt your work a lot?
Oh, yeah. The first time, well, he's my husband's an is a specialist in international media, international communication, so we've been abroad a lot. And the first big trip was in 64, 65, and the paper gave me a leave. The second trip was 68, and they didn't give me a leave. So, I mean, it was either stay or quit, and I have always been ready to go. Somebody said, you want to go around the corner, I'm ready. So, I mean, there was no question that I wouldn't not.
While you were abroad, though?
Not that trip. I mean, I was collecting material for the book that I wrote, a travel cookbook on the mm-hmm. second trip. Mm-hmm. And the first trip, yeah, I did do some correspondence. I mean, it wasn't a regular thing. The regular reporting I did was in 80, 81, from South Africa, for the Milwaukee Journal. I did a weekly column on it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, what effect, then, did the travel have on your family?
Oh, it had a big effect on them. The first trip was, as I say, 60. Well, the first trip as a family was 64, 65. My husband and I traveled through Europe. Both of us took a year off in 54, 55. So we had traveled extensively together in Europe. But as a family, in 64, 65, we spent the fall in Berlin, and the two girls were with us, and they were in the... it was the first and second grade, or the second and third, I can't remember at this point. And then for the second half of that academic year, Bill and I went to Africa, and we sent the girls to live with my sister and her husband in La Jolla.
So you had more time to collect your book.
Well, I didn't collect the book on that one. No, I did a lot of eating in Africa of strange things, and when I wanted to cook them here, I found that when we came back, that there was no cookbook. And so when we went again in 68, then I was collecting stuff for that book. But
did the girls go with you that time?
In 68, the girls went with us. We lugged all their schoolwork, and they were supposed to do a monthly report back to Mr. Allen. they went with us, and I think that was a very positive year for them. They mm-hmm. they found it interesting, and they had some. It was difficult in that it was a traveling fellowship, and we were a month here and then went on to another place and a month there, and so they really never were able to settle in, and their social life consisted of themselves and us. You know, I mean, they mm-hmm. had no friends, and it was. In that sense, it was a little difficult, but they saw a lot of, you know, interesting things, neat things, like Victoria Falls and things kids don't usually see. And safaris, went on a couple of safaris in East Africa and so forth. So that was pretty good. Then in 72, 73, we spent the year in Ghana. And that was better for the older one who had her 17th birthday there than the younger one who was 15. And she didn't want to come. She definitely. In fact, we had tried to find some place for her to stay here. She was trying to get a friend of a mother, the mother of a friend, to various friends to mm-hmm. say that she could stay with
Why
him.
Why didn't she want to go?
Well, she was full. She was very close. She had a coterie of friends with whom she was very close, and they meant a great deal to her. That whole scene. They were a group of girls who had gone to Randall together and then went on to West High. And she had just got accepted into city school and was to go that fall. And she looked forward to that. And even though they agreed to hold her place for her for a year. That didn't satisfy her. She just felt very cut off from her friends. And
so it wasn't really a good year for her.
Huh? No, it wasn't. It wasn't. And she still has some resentments even now about it.
Did you find it difficult coming back when you've been gone for a while to kind of get back into?
Oh yes, I always have incredible culture shock when I come back. Well, culture shock also. Going abroad has always been a great way to just leave everything behind. You know, all your problems and my mother had always been a very, very difficult woman, and I was totally out of reach, you know, as she couldn't make demands on me and lean on me for various things that she always had. She was quite dependent on me for emotional life, I guess you could say. And I always enjoyed my trips abroad, not for that reason as well as, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, that was mm-hmm. one mm-hmm. factor. There were times toward the end of a trip when I'd kind of close my eyes and mentally walk through the house, you know, and remember all the things that I have that I hadn't had, but we all of us developed this incredible nesting. I don't want to say instinct. It was a method of nesting wherever we went. Like, we tried in certain places, we were able to have a apartment situation there are a number of like residential hotels where you mm-hmm. could do your own cooking, and we'd all just settled in. I mean, it got to be a natural way to live, and so that was kind of homey, and we did have fun. We had a lot of fun.
You think it helped draw the family together?
Oh yeah. Oh yes. Uh-huh.
Did your husband find this difficulty coming back too? And
no, he always was looking. He's always toward the end. He gets very antsy to get back. I'm always the one dragging my feet.
Well, it's like making new. He knew what he was coming back to.
Yeah, that's right. And he
started.
That's
again.
Right. And he also, you know, he's always doing research on his trips, so he wants to get back and do mm-hmm. whatever it is he's going to do with it. Write it up, or do articles, or do a book, or use it for lectures or whatever. So, mm-hmm. I mean, he always had something that he was anxious to get back and get started on, whereas I didn't have that.
Mm-hmm. So when you came back, it was again, you know, another start in your career.
Well,
to
to some extent. Yeah.
Was that difficult?
Oh, no, I guess not really. See, I had an unusual childhood in that I once counted up, and in Los Angeles, where I was born and raised, we always seemed to move every 6 months. My mother was always chasing another school, a better school. And
for you?
For me and, mm-hmm. yeah, and my sister and brother later. And I think I figured out once I lived in 27 houses before I was married. And so I was, you know, this was not anything I had never experienced mm-hmm. before. It's starting over, essentially, all the time. And so I really didn't think about it. I really
didn't
think about
it. It sounds as though she had very high expectations.
Oh, yeah, real high. Yeah.
Have you achieved that?
Well, I don't know. My Marianne, the younger one, once we spent a summer with my mother out in California, and or 6 weeks or something, and Marianne must have been about 10 or 11, 9. She wrote her autobiography, and there was a line in there, Maggie, that was my mother. Maggie always wanted her children to be famous even if they weren't. Which was a great way to put it.
But you were satisfied with what you achieved?
Oh yeah, well, I don't know. You know, you always feel, well, if I tried a little harder, maybe, or whatever. But yeah, I'm satisfied with that.
After the State Journal job, what kinds of
Well, then after the State Journal, when I came back, I started, in fact, the day Nixon was inaugurated, I started to write my book. And I finished it 6 months later, and it was sold right away. And but while I was writing it, I also did some teaching at the university, I was always available when they were short of teachers for techniques courses. And then I also was stringing for the Milwaukee Journal, doing long pieces about the university. I did a lot of interviewing of professors, interesting things that they were doing and stuff. And and I did the this Association of Faculty Women. And and then in 73, when we came back from Ghana, Liz, the older one, did not take her 12th year here. She went right into Bryn Mawr. She'd been accepted as a junior, a high school junior. And I went back to work at full time. I was at the State Historical Society. I did their monthly magazine for about 18 months, and then when the public relations person died, I moved into that job and was director of what they call public information. And I did that until the year Marianne, the younger one, graduated college, and then I quit that. And when I did that, that's when I then started my regular column in the Milwaukee Journal Insight magazine on women's issues. And I did that for until 80, pretty close to 80, when I went abroad, when we went back to South Africa for 80, 81, and then I did a column, a weekly piece for them on my experience from Africa, And then when we came back, I was doing Madison Magazine since 79, and then, which is once a month, a column once a month, and then when we came back from South Africa, we started in on the book, Bill's book, which I've been involved with, and that's just now finished. I mean, the final job, the index, was finished a week ago today.
The name of that is?
The Press and Apartheid, : I forgot what comes after all this time. I've forgotten the exact title, but it's something like Propaganda and Repression in South Africa.
So you collaborated on that?
Yeah.
Right. Watching as you taught, how much did you actually teach?
I did about, I do one semester every year, maybe for about, I did that in the early 70s, maybe 3 years in a row before we went to Ghana. And then when I came back, I've done it, three or four more times. I don't do it regularly. I'm not that fond of teaching. So.
Did you see a lot of changes in the students over that time?
Well, yes and no. So much depend. These are techniques courses I teach, and they're limited to 16, so it's very small groups, and a lot of it's the luck of the draw, and sometimes you get very very savvy kids, and sometimes you get kids that are just seem to be from another century sometimes, you know, and not really with it at all in terms of current student concerns or what you think are student concerns. And the last time I taught, which was a year ago this spring semester, was all upperclassmen, seniors mostly, and they were very good, and there were more women than men, and they were very definitely very good, and they'll go out and get good jobs, I'm sure. And they're more, I think they've become quite career oriented than they, a little more than they were in the late 60s.
They're more assertive than they are.
Yeah, well, they're more purposeful. I mean, I think they're, of course, I was teaching seniors most recently, and it's, you know, and when they left the class, they were going out into the cold, cruel world, so they were very concerned about what was going to happen next. And, but I don't know, you know, the whole feel of the 60s was, that wasn't the primary concern to be on campus. You know, there were other things happening then, and fulfillment and all that.
Right, you went through the protest movement.
Yes, yes.
What effect did that have on the department?
The department is a very closely knit, a very homogeneous, or was in those days, probably still is. I don't recall any really bitter divisions within the department over the issues of the 60s, as there were, I understand, in other departments. It was pretty, not that everybody agreed, and there were very strong anti-war sentiments, but there wasn't the acrimony that there was, or maybe there wasn't the passion, I don't know. But I don't think the department, those years.
Did journalists just look at things more objectively?
Well, I like to think so. Yeah.
Did it have a much effect on your family?
Yeah, I think it had a profound effect on my children growing up when they did. I think they got radicalized very early, and they became involved in issues that I think they became involved in a little too young. The younger one particularly became a real activist and became all involved when she was in the ninth grade with pro-choice movement. That's been a consistent interest of hers, but she's just very passionate about things, and maybe she probably would have been to some extent anyway, but she had a lot of encouragement
right.
and a lot of impatience, and she's the one who really, you know, was big on the alternative education sort of approach, and neither of them wanted to go here, neither of them did, and
Why do you think that they made that choice?
The younger one, Mary Ann, went to Hampshire College, which is an alternative type situation. Right? No exams, no grades. You design your own major and that sort of thing.
And that was very much encouraged.
Oh yeah,
at that time.
That's right. And the older one just didn't want to stay around Madison. She wasn't quite as caught up as Marianne.
In retrospect, now that they're out of school, a lot of them aren't, are they?
One is just finishing graduate school, and the other is just starting graduate school.
How do they feel about growing up in Madison?
Liz, the older one who went to Bryn Mawr then, was in New York for a while, and has completed 2 years at Columbia Law School and decided she didn't like the law, so she came back to Madison, which I think was interesting. And Mary Ann also has a real strong pull. I know I recommended that she see Breaking Away, you know, that movie about that was late in Indiana and Bloomington, and a couple years ago, and she finally saw it, and I said, how'd you like it? She said, I loved it. She said, I went with a bunch of people. They didn't like it much, but she said, you know, I'm into the Midwest. So maybe someday she'll come back.
What about the protest movement effect in different departments and on your friends? You said you had a lot of friends in other departments. Did you notice a big difference there?
I heard about, you know, certain departments where perhaps the younger faculty weren't talking to the older faculty, and there was a lot of that there was some acrimony. And we'd go to parties, and I personally would just get terribly upset with some people I thought were very level-headed, and they didn't agree with me. I mean, mostly, this I remember so vividly was during the sit-downs, you know, when the Dow, when they were in, Dow was interviewing, and these students sat down, and then about two nights later, we were at a big party, and you remember the police came and hauled them away, and there was a few got tapped with nightsticks and things, and they were outraged. And some of these of our contemporaries, faculty contemporaries, not in journalism, you know, were just outraged at the police, and I couldn't understand why, if you're going to, they thought they shouldn't have been arrested, and if you're going to involve yourself in civil disobedience, I think that's fine, but you have to take the consequences, which is obviously, I mean, if you're going to be disobedient, you're going to get arrested. I thought that was the whole point. It was a difficult time, I must say it was, socially and in all ways. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Did your husband feel this also?
Well, I don't think it really ever interfered at all in the conduct of the department. Mm-hmm. Certainly not ours.
But it was a time when there were a lot of students coming into the department.
That came, no, in journalism, later. That was a little later. Uh-huh. It was after the big explosion. It was starting to build up in the early 70s, but of course the big explosion was after Watergate. Mm-hmm. And that really became a big thing, you know, journalism as something to study. But I don't think the protest had anything to do with it.